In the summer of 1985, the National Association of Congregational Christian Churches held their annual conference in Maine. A state Billy and I had wanted to visit for a long time. We enjoyed the church conference near Portland for 3 days. Then we drove up the coast to a cottage on Pemaquid Bay. Our son and his wife joined us, and sometimes at night, worn out with sightseeing, we would sit in the living room and play the game that was at the height of its popularity that summer, Trivial Pursuits. I like the name. Hundreds of minute little questions, pure trivia, which, if you could answer, would let you advance your game piece until you won. People whose heads are stuffed with microchips of information do well at this game, and I suppose it also helps to have a few more years of living. So Billy and I won and enjoyed the children's disbelief that we could win, and decided over a glass of good wine together that we had taught them humility and respect for a while longer. When I came home that summer, I found we had one of the spin-outs from that game in our church library, Biblical Trivia Pursuits. I looked at some of the cards. What street did Paul go to in Damascus? I knew the useless, unimportant answer. A street called Straight. Name one of Job's three daughters. I could do that. Karen Hoppock. And I knew there was also Keziah and Jemima. Who was Bildad, the Shuhite? Not the shortest man in the Bible, despite the old seminary joke, but one of Job's comforters. I remembered them all. Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, and a fourth one, finally, who came along after that first three. And so what? Trivia. You could show off with it, if showing off like that were important, but it wouldn't help you much in a time of despair or in a moment of temptation when you had a tough decision to make. No more important, really, than learning the state capitals. Memory work that gave the head a little workout but left the heart untouched. I grew up in a church that liked to promote these little games of Bible knowledge, and since I was a fiercely competitive kid, I loved them. I wanted to beat my classmates, but especially I wanted to show up the Methodists and Baptists who were ignorant of God's will and did not have, as we did, the one and only truth. I thought it might be proof that I was God's own favorite little boy if I could recite all 66 books of the Bible in proper sequence. So I learned to rattle them off, although I discovered in later studies that they are not in proper sequence after all, but only in the order in which some misinformed human beings had placed them a long time ago. And trivia, after all, a minor mechanical convenience to memorize the table of contents of the Bible, but not worth the understanding of even the shortest verse in that whole library, which happens to be John 11:35. Jesus wept. For years, the teacher would say, "What's the shortest verse in the Bible?" A trivia question before the game was ever invented, and I would sing out, "Jesus wept." But the thought of what that revealed about him, the comforting poignancy of it, never once occurred to me. So I've been thinking about trivial pursuits. I have a marvelous lab for observation. I pass students in hallways all day long. I hear what they talk about. Pretty much the same things we talked about when we were that age, except that I think they do not read quite so much or hold quite so many of those philosophical bull sessions in which some of us learned more than we learned in the classroom. I do not blame them. I feel pity that they have so many more things screaming for their attention, so that if they are not disciplined and careful, they fill up with trivia. The true indictment of modern life in America is that we live not bad but frittered lives. Unable to put first things first, unable even to know for sure what the first things are. I have yet to get over the surprise of finding that students so often read as little as possible. Francis Bacon can say to them all he likes, "Reading maketh a full man," but they have no time for it. I ask about this book or that, books everybody once read in high school, and two hands go up out of 35 people. They have to go to school. They are students, they tell me, and they just don't have time to read. And the irony of what they have said does not occur to them. Their fathers and mothers may read, but what they read may be trash from the mountains of trash that invite us now to take them in. I visited someone not long ago, not one of our people, and noticed the two cheap and shallow books on the hospital bedside table, not harmful books. And I hate sounding like teacher and preacher at the same time, but they were junk. Not the kinds of books Charles Kingsley had in mind when he said, "Except a living man, there is nothing more wonderful than a book." Or that Charles Lamb had in mind when he said he thought we ought to say grace over them. They were so valuable. Not harmful books, just books that took up time that might have been so much better used. Seeing them on the table, I thought of the loss I sometimes feel when I read too much of the daily paper. Knowing the truth of John Ruskin's great question, do you know if you read this that you cannot read that? So I preach to myself, hoping to learn better all the time how to shut the door on idle curiosity and open it to things that matter. I've spent my life in schools and churches. I've spoken of trivia in the first. There is trivia also in the second. Life in the ministry can be an amazing roller coaster of emotions. A minister can be refereeing a squabble of trivial importance in the morning. Somebody said that somebody didn't like something or other. And in the afternoon, be sitting at the bedside of a woman with cancer, wondering what words to say when there are no words to say. It happened to me once in another church that a group of church school teachers were upset because mention of their work had been inadvertently left out of the church bulletin when similar accolades were being handed out to others in their same line of work. In other words, somebody got credit for something they all did, and they were furious over being left out of the spotlight. Word of it came to me by telephone, just as I was leaving to make a hospital call. The woman I went to see that day in St. Louis had cancer of the esophagus. Her hair had fallen out from chemotherapy. She had no voice. Her eyes were so bloodshot I could not tell where pupil and iris were. She had two small children and a husband who loved her dearly. And she was dying at 28. I'd seen the doctor before I walked in. He told me she had a couple of weeks. I was too shaken to think of it beside her bed, but when I walked out of Barnes Hospital that day, I thought of what I had dealt with in 2 hours' time. Petty people, first, with soap opera hysterics over nothing, and a woman on whom life had played one of its cruelest and most tragic jokes, and who had summoned up just enough strength to whisper thanks that I had come. I wanted to drag each small, selfish person who had complained about an oversight down to that dying woman's room and invite them all to sit there and tell her why they were upset. Haul out their trivial pursuits and have them stared at by her eyes until their words choked in their mouths. And just this year, when some of my students wrote papers, assigned papers, on the man or woman they most admired, I read a new and unintended description of the trivial life. Under the heading, "The Man I Most Admire," a boy wrote these words. "A few months ago, I was thinking about my future goals. I thought about the occupation that I would enjoy most, the lifestyle that I would feel comfortable with, and the car of my dreams. After reviewing my dream future, I discovered that I had described my father's life. I obviously had realized before this that I looked up tremendously to my dad. He has done the one thing that most people would love to do, accomplish most or all of his goals. Listen carefully. He is able to live comfortably in a country club atmosphere. His living standard has been possible through a well-paying, enjoyable job. His job has also enabled him to buy his favorite car, a Corvette. If someone were to ask him to list other things that he would want from his life, I'm sure that he could come up with some items. But to want more is just human nature. From my point of view, there isn't much more to be desired in my most admired person's life." I read it over again. Not a word about integrity, sacrifice, compassion, kindness, love, wisdom, courage, the qualities for which we are told we should admire people. Only good pay, high living, country club life, and a Corvette. All good things, but none the highest things. And a son who has not noticed. So much for trivial pursuits. And a word quickly about perverted priorities, which is not, after all, a very different world from the one we've just been describing. I want you to meet someone, you may already have done so, who seems to me to have his priorities right. A few days ago, Garrison Keillor, whose Prairie Home companion on National Public Radio has built up a large following over the past few years, decided to give up his show. He would seem to be still rising in terms of popularity and marketability, with a best-selling book like Woebegone Days and the prospect of making more and more money over the next 10 or 15 years. But he has announced his retirement and caught all of his fans by surprise. His explanation, I thought, fit perfectly with a discussion of priorities. He says, It is simply time to go. I want to resume the life of a shy person and live with my affectionate family a more peaceful life, a life in which there are Saturdays. I think he has some priorities in order. Cliff Sucher, a friend of mine among congregational ministers, had a provocative note in the bulletin of his Mansfield, Ohio church. He pointed out that we are now hearing with increasing frequency the number of dollars being spent or owed by the federal government expressed in trillions rather than millions or billions. 1 trillion is just a pair of words that rhymes with 1 billion until we break it down into costs that are more familiar. Cliff quotes a writer who does that. For $1 trillion, you could build a $75,000 house, place it on $5,000 worth of land, furnish it with $10,000 worth of furniture, put a $10,000 car in the garage, and give this to each and every family in Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, Iowa, Oklahoma, and Colorado. Having done this, you would still have enough left to build a $10 million hospital and a $10 million library for each of 250 cities and towns through the 6-state area. After having done all that, you would still have enough money left to build 500 schools at $10 million each for all the communities in that region. Then you would have enough left out of the trillion to put aside at 10% annual interest a sum of money that would pay a salary of $25,000 per year for an army of 10,000 nurses, the same salary for an army of 10,000 teachers, and an annual cash allowance of $5,000 for each and every family throughout the 6-state region, not just for 1 year, but forever. In another place, in a book called World Military and Social Expenditures, I learn that in a book with annual military expenditures of $800 billion, one adult in three cannot read and write, and one person in four is hungry. That in 1 year, the Soviet Union spends more on military defense than the governments of all the developing countries spend on education and health care for their 3.6 billion people. That it costs the United States $590,000 a day to operate one aircraft carrier, while homeless people sleep on winter streets and the children of poverty are often too hungry to have any interest in what happens in a classroom. I cannot argue that such things are not necessary in a world of hostility and ill will. But I can argue that when we propose to spend $2 trillion on military hardware and projects over the next 5 years, we confess in huge block letters that we are still failing dismally on this planet to get our priorities right. The church has only a small voice to raise against this cacophony of fear and suspicion, but it has to speak forever and ever without ceasing in the hope that one day the kingdoms of this world will become what the dream dares to imagine, the kingdom of love and justice and cooperation, where the first things shall finally be put in first place, however far off that hope may seem. You and I cannot stop holding it. In the name of Christ, our Lord. Amen.